I'm Martin Carly, and I like to popularize science. Vaccination against COVID-19 for children aged 5 to 11 has begun. As parents, you may be asking if your child will receive the same vaccine as adults. The vaccine used for children younger than 12 years old contains a smaller amount of mRNA because children's immune systems respond better than those of adults. And even though they're given smaller doses, the vaccine is just as effective.
For more information, visit quebec.ca/youthvaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Listening to the 972 podcast. Every episode, we explore issues and stories about Israel-Palestine that other media outlets tend to ignore. I'm your host, Natasha Roth-Rowland. Our guest on this episode is the Palestinian-American writer Sahar Mustafa, whose debut novel, The Beauty of Your Face, was published last year to widespread acclaim. The story revolves around Afaf Rahman, the daughter of Palestinian immigrants in the Chicago suburbs, who is the principal of a Muslim girls' school. The narrative moves back and forth between the present day, when a white nationalist shooter is attacking a fast school, and various stages of her childhood, adolescence, and early adulthood. We witness Afaf grappling with the vanishing of her older sister, Nada, who goes to school one day and never returns, and with the ongoing turmoil of her mother, who has never recovered from her emigration from Palestine. We also see Afaf's struggle to define herself and her place in the world, caught between her own sense of self and how others perceive her, from the teenage boys she encounters in school, to the Muslim women who welcome her into their religious community, to the airport security personnel who scrutinize her as she travels for Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, in a post-9/11 world. Mustafa, who is based in Chicago, is a high school teacher and the daughter of Palestinian immigrants. Her short stories have won numerous awards, including her collection, The Code of the West, which was published in 2017. Sahar Mustafa, welcome to the 972 podcast. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
The Beauty of Your Face is in one sense a story about a family, but it also tackles big themes and topics such as immigration, Palestine, Islamophobia, and white nationalist violence, among others. Can you tell us about how and why you set out to tell this story?
So the idea came to me as a result of the very tragic hate killings of three young Muslim Americans in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. They were killed in cold blood by their white neighbor. That would have been February 2015. And it was the kind of event that, you know, just rattled me to my core, as it did so many others here in the United States and certainly across the world. I, you know, as a fiction writer, I'm just always exploring these, you know, really incredible experiences and incidents. And fiction has just always allowed me a chance to try to arrive at some of the questions that I had, such as, you know, what compels someone that, you know, a neighbor to, you know, bring a gun to your door and shoot you in cold blood. And, you know, as a teacher, I've been teaching for almost 25 years now. You know, I've always been just really cognizant of the dangers of gun violence. But this particular event was different from a young person, a student bringing a gun to school. This was an adult, and it was rooted in this deep Islamophobic hatred and fear. And I knew that it would be more than the space of a short story. So I'd been writing short stories for quite a while. And I realized that, you know, I was embarking on, you know, quite a journey. And so this became the first novel that I published. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that it made it into the world.
So the novel begins with two cataclysms. Firstly, the main character, Faf, hearing gunfire in the Muslim girls' school, where she's the principal. And secondly, decades earlier, the mysterious disappearance of Faf's older sister, Nada, when they are both still children. What was your thinking behind opening the book this way? Was there some particular connection you were trying to draw? Or did you see parallels between the two events in any way?
It was very deliberate. You know, I start in the present tense when Afaf is the principal of the school. But I knew that if I was going to tell a story such as this one, I'd have to go back to the beginning in order to dispel, you know, some of the, you know, pretty volatile perceptions of Muslims Americans. So I needed to take that journey, you know, with Afaf, and going back in time allowed me to explore how she came very strongly to Islam, but also the bigotry, the racism that she had been enduring, you know, since she was school age. And you know, it's this idea of, if we're going to be examining, you know, these pretty extraordinary and pretty violent experiences, you know, we need to explore the stories that have carried us to this moment in time. I don't think it would have been a complete story had it just been present tense and us not getting to know Afaf and how she and the shooter and their lives end up intersecting and colliding in this really tragic way. But it also gave me an opportunity, you know, when I speak of the stories that we carry, to explore from the shooter's point of view. So, you know, he's got limited page time as well. And so I guess this is all to say that, you know, if we don't step back and, you know, examine all of the forces, all of the choices that bring us to these critical moments in time, I think we're doing a grave disservice when we try to dismantle, you know, racism, patriarchy. I think it's necessary to get to those lived experiences. And you know, again, I'm just able to do that, you know, through fictionalizing those real experiences.
We'll get back to the shooter in a moment. But I wanted us to talk a little bit about Afaf's mother. because reading the book, it feels very much as if her grief is one of the main driving forces in the story. Her grief over the loss of her daughter, of course, but also over the loss of Palestine, or at least her place in it when she emigrated to the United States. Can you talk about the role of grief in immigration, and particularly about how it plays out when leaving a place like Palestine?
Yes, thank you for the question. Muntaha was also, Natasha, probably one of the most complex characters I had to write. You know, some people think it, you know, immediately that it's the shooter, but Muntaha, because of everything that, you know, you just prefaced in this question, is what made her, you know, this really complicated exploration for me. And yes, her grief is what fractures the family. And, you know, that grief is also very complex. So we've got the burden of her leaving her homeland, and that being Palestine, which I think is, you know, her leaving and grieving is I think, you know, quite beautiful, because, you know, America is supposed to be the place where, you know, she can be free and, you know, live the American dream. But, you know, she wants to go back to a place that is still, you know, politically, militarily occupied, where, you know, opportunities are quite limited. But it's the only place that she's ever felt like she belonged. And so when Neda disappears, you know, that just really, you know, further destroys her, because Neda is also another part of Palestine to her. You know, that she, her husband and Neda are natives of Palestine. You know, her two other children, Afaf and her brother Majid, are actually born in the United States. So Neda disappearing sort of breaks away another part of her, you know, and she still was that link to Palestine. And that, you know, again, is just so debilitating and, you know, further displaces her in a way and removes her from that homeland. And, you know, that again is what colors what might be this sort of general or even, you know, shared and typical grief in losing a child. But I would say that Palestinian identity, you know, offers this sort of complicated layer for sure.
Yeah, I guess I have a follow-up question to that, which I want to ask without giving too much about the story away. But I think what felt very implicit to me at times was just also this grappling with assimilation. And I think Neda was quite central to that grappling in, you know, in ways that you've just mentioned, but in other ways as well. And I just wondered if you had a message about what it is to struggle with assimilating or not, that you were trying to communicate through this storyline.
Yeah. You know, I think, and I hope I've communicated this well, assimilation is a failed experiment. You know, it's this one-way street. You know, individuals who are leaving their countries for various reasons come to the United States and are expected to check that particular identity and their culture at the door. So assimilation is sort of this forced absorption, right, in the larger white patriarchal society here in the United States. And this is really problematic, you know, for a family like Afaf's, who are Palestinian, who are trying to, you know, create or replant roots, I should say, and are still trying to hold on to that native heritage, which, as we see in the 70s with Afaf, is, you know, ostensibly rejected, you know, at every point in her life, starting most intimately at school, which is where, you know, our first communities are formed outside of our families. So, yeah, I wanted to show through Neda particularly that really horrible struggle with young people who are first and second generation, who are trying to balance the pressure of belonging as, quote, you know, Americans, and their parents still, you know, really clinging to them, so that that cultural, that racial identity doesn't completely disappear. And I think, you know, had the sort of host country been more determined and adamant about helping these particular immigrant families and communities preserve their culture, I don't think we would have the issues that, that, you know, we see in Atef's life and her journey to Islam that we see later on. Assimilation. I don't know that there has been anything positive. I mean, this. I think integration is a different kind of attempt. I don't think, you know, when we say we want to integrate, you know, to me, there are certainly more positive connotations to that. But assimilation is becoming the same as basically that host country. And, you know, so much then is lost in that native identity. And again, for a family like Afaf, it becomes another kind of displacement.
Let's go back to the shooter and what he represents. He inhabits this alt-right online bubble, and you sort of parse some of the comments that they make and that he's exposed to, and they seem especially fixated on Muslim women as the symbol of their own sense of loss of power and status. And there's also racialized misogyny at work in Afaf's humiliating treatment by the white boys and even teachers she encounters as a schoolgirl. Are these two arcs of the story connected in your mind?
Oh, yes, definitely. So I was trying to demonstrate that, you know, Afaf had been victimized, you know, much earlier in her life, starting when, you know, she's 10 years old and is actually, you know, she is shut out of educational opportunities. You know, her teacher assumes that she's not at the higher reading level and, you know, groups her in the lowest remedial level. And when she becomes a teenager, when she is, you know, undergoing puberty and, you know, grappling with that, you know, very difficult and challenging adolescent experience, you know, she becomes exoticized, you know, by the white young men at her school. You know, we see with a classmate named Michael, you know, she finds herself, you know, she's in his bedroom and, you know, that particular chapter opens up with the idea that, you know, he can preserve her virginity by basically, you know, penetrating her in this other way. And I have to say, Natasha, it was also a very difficult period for me to write. So the teenage years were pretty rough in this particular manuscript. So we see that kind of gendered racism and the exoticizing of the Arab, you know, Muslim girl. And even in the way that the dean is so dismissive of her and, you know, the jokes that she hears, you know, from educators about, you know, being part of a harem. So all of that is quite damaging, you know, and Afaf at this point is really between worlds because she's also rejected to a point by her Arab community. And, you know, she's not really accepted as this, you know, sexual object by white community. And when we see her later on and in her community, you know, she finds Islam and, you know, she decides a little bit later, you know, she comes to Islam actually as a young person. She's a senior in high school. It's actually at the end of her teenage years that we see the beginning of this transformation. And she doesn't wear the hijab until some years after, you know, she enters into the circle of women. So she's actually been quite shielded, you know. So she starts to practice Islam in a really meaningful way. But she still has not made that leap. And when she makes it, you know, she starts to become the victim of, you know, just the really awful bigotry, because now she's become she's visibly Muslim. And that identity is unmistakable, right? Ostensibly. And so when we alternate points of view with the shooter, you know, we see that same kind of exoticizing with not just Muslim women, but we also get that incident, without giving away too much, with the Indian neighbor who's moved into the complex. And we also get a pretty, you know, horrendous episode of him violating that Indian woman in a different way than what we see with Afaf, but nonetheless, you know, she is also sexualized. So, you know, those particular threads are definitely, you know, they intersect. And I know I was doing that on a conscious level as I was thinking about Afaf's experiences and the experiences of the other Muslim women and the other women of color in her parts of her story, but also as they appear with the shooter.
Who did you imagine as your audience when you were writing the novel?
This is such a great question. And I don't think the audience has changed since writing this particular novel, but I was thinking of my immediate Arab, Palestinian, and Muslim communities. You know, I'm not going to pretend that I didn't want this, you know, to break into mainstream. I feel, you know, it deserved to also be part of mainstream publishing. But I definitely set out to tell a story that I had not yet read before, and one that expands the narratives around these communities. And I can share with you, Natasha, it was precisely, I think, because I was writing to those audiences, you know, I preserved the shooter, that was pushed back against by certain editors and agents. So when I was querying this manuscript, so many of them loved Afaf's story, but they wanted to package it as the immigrant story, and they wanted me to drop the shooter. And I just wouldn't do that. And I wouldn't budge. I have to admit that my confidence definitely was shattered, because I started to think, my goodness, maybe this was not going to enter into the world unless I basically packaged this in a way that, you know, the white publishing gatekeepers, you know, found palatable. But I kept with it, and you know, I feel fortunate to have found an agency and then a publisher that stood by this particular story. So, you know, again, you know, I'm thinking about that immediate and close community of friends and family, and I should also you know, share here, Natasha, that I was so concerned about their reactions to it. I was really, you know, just full of insecurity and anxiety, you know, as this was about to be launched. And when I got the early responses from readers, and then there were a few writers who are in my, you know, literary circles, when I got their responses, and they were so affirming, it was just, you know, just so wonderful. And I felt, you know, one reader talked about how I had, quote, gotten it right. And, you know, that I felt also like a responsibility. So I knew what they were referencing, this idea that I finally had a platform and I was going to tell a story that was meaningful and authentic. And again, cast, you know, Palestinian Muslims in, you know, I would say in a new light, but then also in a positive light, but not without, you know, their flaws. You know, these are still human beings, but I think, you know, it was a new story for many readers, particularly, you know, white readers, but then also for those immediate communities who had not seen themselves represented in this way. And then also that just the kind of daily threat that Muslims, Palestinians, Arabs, you know, experience in this country. And it is most acutely, I'm certain, with, again, women who are visibly Muslim, you know, hijabi women. I felt like this was an important and essential opportunity to tell, you know, a particular story. And I hope it was successful.
In the past few years, there's been a real sense of Palestinian American activists accumulating grassroots power, which has been accompanied by a growing awareness of Palestinian voices coming out of the Middle East. But that's also being met with increasing efforts in the US to exclude Palestinian narratives from the public space, including classrooms. As an educator, how are you thinking about this political moment?
Yeah, and it is an incredible political moment. You know what I think has shifted or at least expanded, Natasha, is the intersectionality of Palestinian rights and Black lives. And so what I've witnessed, what I've been really, you know, paying attention to and I've been attuned to is how these particular communities have been, you know, rallying for each other. And I think that has then sort of shed light on the Palestinian cause and the struggle. And I think we're beginning to move away from Palestinians, you know, being this sort of invisible kind of cause that, you know, only some people care about. But I think it's also been, you know, obviously it's been conflated with anti-Semitism. And I feel like that particular argument is starting to dissolve. So I think we're in really exciting times. You know, I think BDS is, you know, has been empowered. And, you know, we saw Sally Rooney, who's the Irish writer who stood behind Palestinians and declined the Israeli publisher for her latest novel. So, you know, I think, you know, the Palestinian American activism has always been there, but I think it's become more amplified, you know, in this particular way in terms of Black lives. But that's not the only way, of course. And now we're starting to see it spill into curriculum. Now, I think there's still a lot of work to do because, you know, there's still, you know, many, many schools. And, you know, we're seeing this at the college level, but then also at the high school level. Where the any mention of Palestine and Palestinians is absolutely, you know, banned from regular curriculum. And that is unfortunate. But I think it even being presented at board meetings and you know, very, very intentionally dialogued and, you know, people gathering, you know, around these conversations, I think it's been really affirming and really, really hopeful. So I think that work is still slow going. And I can tell you, you know, I had a firsthand experience in a contemporary poetry unit. I presented a Palestinian poet and immediately, you know, there were complaints and I had to sort of, you know, combat those complaints. But I was able to stand firm on this particular selection. But that was, frankly, without board approval. So I think what's happening is normalizing the issue of Palestine. And that can only happen with board, you know, with school boards standing behind it and approving it, and teachers being able to teach it, you know, without fear, you know, of losing their jobs and of, you know, just repercussions and having to deal with, you know, those pockets that want to continue to silence and, you know, who want to perpetuate and, you know, continue to push the Israeli lobby and agenda. So I have to say I've been the most optimistic and hopeful, I would say, in the last few years. But, you know, that always feels, you know, sort of pushed against with the continuing, you know, violence and killings and then silencing. You know, I'm thinking of the six organizations that have been deemed, you know, terrorists, have been declared terrorist organizations. So there is still a lot of work, but I think Palestine has entered the public conversation in a way that I've not seen in, you know, the last 10 years. So I'm feeling, you know, pretty positive and hopeful for sure. And I think the issue of Palestine also is very well connected to social justice. And that has been, you know, a prominent component of curricula in many high schools. And again, you know, there has been so much pushback, but I think it's time has arrived. So I think that is the perfect place for the issue of Palestine to be explored, to enter, you know, into the classroom. And I don't think that we make, you know, progress if we don't begin in schools. I mean, it needs to happen there, and it needs to happen with younger students for sure.
In recent years, we've seen a number of notable debuts by Palestinian American writers, and particularly Palestinian American women. Alongside The Beauty of Your Face, we've also had first-time novels from Hala Alian, Zeina Arafat, and Et Afrum, to name just a few. What are your thoughts on today's Palestinian American literary scene and Arab American literature in general? How do you see them in relation to previous generations of literary works, and where do you hope to see them go in the future?
It's incredible, Natasha. So when my novel was released, it was released in the same year that there were three other Palestinian American books that were also launched. Now, Zeina Arafat, she and I were both debuts. And then there was a poetry collection by George Abraham. And then later on in the year, we received Against the Loveless World by Susan Abulhawa. And that book is just absolutely extraordinary. And I hope your audience gets a chance to read it. And so, you know, writers like Susan Abulhawa really have paved the way, you know, for what we're seeing now. I think these voices, again, have definitely, you know, we've always been here, but we just might not have entered into the mainstream, you know, literary publishing world, except maybe for recent years. And I just remember when I started my MFA, I was so concerned about, you know, will there be a place for me? Will someone want to publish, you know, these short stories that take place here, but then also are set in Palestine, in the occupied West Bank? You know, are these going to fly, you know, basically? And in some ways, you know, I want to say that I'm fortunate, but I don't think, you know, I want to frame it in that way. Because again, I think, you know, we deserve, you know, to have that space and, you know, we've earned it. And, that I think is connected to, the way we're seeing Palestine and, you know, what we were just talking about, just moments before about activism. And I think, you know, writers, poets, they're always going to present, you know, a community's humanity in the most beautiful and gut-wrenching and, you know, just poignantly tragic ways. I feel like books, particularly fiction, you know, they tend to disarm people who, you know, come come to these communities with biases. And some of those are pretty, they might be pretty narrow or pretty inflamed, bigoted views. And I think there's just something really beautiful when we pick up a book and we enter into a story. We are allowing ourselves to be carried, you know, through this particular journey in a really intimate and engaged way. So that is to say that, you know, writers are so critical and necessary as, you know, we are trying to free Palestine. I think, you know, the arts and literature for me, it's my way to forward that activism that has always been where I felt empowered and have felt seen and heard. And I take that responsibility, you know, really seriously, to the point that, you know, it becomes a burden, you know, when I think about, what am I putting on the page and how is that going to be received? And, you know, is this furthering a cause or is it sort of diminishing? And I've been having Natasha to grapple with that. And then, of course, my creative impulses and being true to my voice. So I hope that's answered that question.
Absolutely. Thank you. Sahara Mustafa, thank you so much for being on the 972 podcast.
Thank you so much.
This episode was produced by me, Natasha Roth-Rowland, and the editors at 972 Magazine.
This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We are a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world. Over the last few weeks, we've seen some major news stories break about Israel's cyber surveillance of Palestinians, from the hacking of Palestinian NGO staff phones to the mass deployment of facial recognition software to be used against Palestinians across the West Bank. Now, mass surveillance of Palestinians by the Israeli regime is nothing new. And whilst this level of technological sophistication is novel, it's important to contextualize it within the panopticon reality that Palestinians have always experienced since the establishment of the Zionist settler colonial project in historic Palestine. Joining me to discuss this topic is Mona Shtayyeh, a digital communication and advocacy strategist and the advocacy advisor for Hamle, the Arab Center for Social Media Advancement. Mona, thank you for joining me on Rethinking Palestine.
Thanks, Yara, for having me here. I really love the podcast.
Mona, Palestinians have long argued that they are essentially a laboratory or testing ground for weapons and surveillance technologies. Before we delve into what has been happening over the last few weeks, could you summarize what surveillance looks like for Palestinians on a daily basis, particularly in the West Bank and Gaza?
Definitely, Yara. So nowadays, with the spread of the surveillance technologies and with the technologies generally, I can say the Israeli colonization was also developed to include abusing people's data and privacy. And for the past decade, the Israeli regime has been producing and testing the surveillance technologies on Palestinians as a part of their military industry. And then it produces it massively and sell it to the other governments and regimes around the world to be used to control their people. Facial recognition techniques, spywares on mobile phones, spreading cameras to control the population, monitoring every telephone call in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and monitoring social media platforms, and either arresting people based on what they published on social media or pushing the social media companies to take down a specific content, are all forms on the shrunk spaces that Palestinians are facing because of these systematic efforts to surveil them. Over the past couple of weeks, we saw many reports on the surveillance tools that are used to monitor Palestinians. Some may be surprised by them, but digital rights defenders, we were expecting something like this, especially when the Israeli regime worked systematically during the pandemic to normalize surveillance culture in order to expand its profit from this occupation.
Mona, you mentioned that Palestinians were not particularly surprised by the recent events and the recent news of this mass surveillance. And that's because surveillance of Palestinians, even prior to these relatively new and novel technologies, has a historic track record. The Israeli regime has often used human personnel, spies, various different mechanisms to surveil Palestinians. What does this mean for daily life for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza? How does that surveillance affect their lived realities?
Well, let's talk about people feeling toward these surveillance technologies. Last week, we at Hamle have produced and published a new report on the facial recognition cameras that was in East Jerusalem. But also, the same report came out of The Guardian, which was mentioned the Blue Wolf and the White Wolf. It also mentioned the surveillance cameras and the facial recognition in Hebron and many other places around the West Bank. This kind of surveillance usually creates a higher self-censorship among Palestinians and create a feeling of living in an unsafe place. While we are living under this kind of occupation or settler colonialism regime that we are living under like for the past decades, now we recognize that this kind of occupation is not only on the ground, it's also applicable on the digital spaces, on the online spaces. So this kind of militarization and securitization affect people's behavior, affect people's feeling toward the society that they are living in. And to be honest with you, in our report, we've heard people's experience with these cameras. One of them is a woman who's living in East Jerusalem, and she mentioned that she can't take off her hijab even inside her home because she feels that she is surveilled all the time, even inside her home. She swore that she's sleeping with her hijab. And this kind of politics of fear, they are intended to spread and to normalize among Palestinians, but people are much more aware. We've seen also other kinds of surveillance that they also utilize and use with Palestinians. For example, during May escalations, we saw how they sent SMS messages to people, to worshippers who were in Al-Aqsa Mosque. They told them that you have participating in violent, quote-unquote, violent work in Al-Aqsa Mosque. And because of that, we will hold you accountable. And by doing so, we recognize that they also are using the GPS to monitor Palestinians and to surveil Palestinians. And this is also a violation of their right to privacy. When we are violating people's right to privacy, people kind of start fearing and start feeling scary about their life. And sometimes with the self-censorship, they stop talking, stop criticizing, and they even stop expressing themselves. And that's scary. That's disastrous in terms of the context that we are living in Palestine.
Mona, that's incredibly important to note that this kind of surveillance is not only about gathering information, but it's also part of a scaremongering tactic, an attempt to make Palestinians constantly uncomfortable so that they can't do anything else and that they have to self-censor. So it's also part of this sort of attempt to depoliticize Palestinian society. Now, some weeks ago, the Israeli Ministry of Defense criminalized 6 Palestinian human rights NGOs. And it's not particularly surprising, but questions were asked, why now and what purpose does it serve, particularly as the Israeli regime doesn't need any excuse to arrest Palestinians, to raid offices, to confiscate files. But what's becoming clear is that the Israeli regime likely rushed this criminalization because both Citizen Lab and Amnesty International found Israeli spyware, in particular Pegasus, on the devices of staff members. And in other words, you know, one of the reasons for this criminalization was an attempt to whitewash or to excuse this hacking. And indeed, it's a lot easier to justify this level of surveillance on organizations that you claim are terrorist rather than human rights organizations. So could you perhaps tell us a bit more about this?
Well, the six Palestinians who were surveilled by Pegasus, which is a malicious spyware developed by the Israeli company NSO, which was recently listed on the US blacklist for manufacturing and supplying foreign authorities with spywares. They were working in human rights organizations. And as I mentioned previously, oppressive regimes such as the Israeli regime usually use surveillance techniques to restrict the human rights work, silencing human rights activists and preventing them from documenting human rights violations against citizens in the occupied Palestinian territories in a systematic manner. And for years, Palestinian civil society organizations, including the six mentioned organizations, have faced restrictions on civic workspaces, some of which had previously faced systematic smearing campaigns with the aim of defaming them and restricting their work. Al-Haq was one of the organizations that were accused by the Israeli regime of being, quote-unquote, a terrorist organization, which had previously witnessed a smear campaign with the aim of restricting its work and preventing it from practicing human rights work and documenting human rights violations that we as Palestinians are exposed to on the ground. It is clear that these campaigns were not fruitful as the Israeli authorities desired. And accordingly, the authorities began monitoring a group of workers in these organizations. And as we can see from Frontline Defenders' report, they started surveilling two of these six human rights defenders since 2020. And earlier this year, Amnesty International had published a detailed report about NSO, which was historically used to be a suspicious link that should be clicked to hack your device. But in the last couple of years, the company developed its technology to create this zero-click spyware where they can hack your device whenever they want. And this dangerous spyware could have access to all your data, messages, photos, and calls. And this is not the first time that the Israeli regime uses the logic of whitewashing crimes and human rights violations. This is their method of work. For example, at the beginning of the pandemic, the authorities start using mobile applications under the pretext of protecting public health. And we knew that this reason was a justification for legislating the use of surveillance technologies and normalizing people's acceptance of them. Unfortunately, many governments succeeded in this. The Israeli authorities also asked Palestinian citizens to download the coordinator or munasiq application on their phones to obtain permits to go to their work. This was all questionable. And unfortunately, today we are talking about mass surveillance of Palestinians in the digital spaces and on the ground. And it is clear that we are sinking in a pool of surveillance, and I'm not sure if we can get out of it.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis, and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work. And Muna, as if this spyware wasn't scary enough, around the same time as the news broke about Pegasus, the Washington Post published an expose on how the Israeli regime is incorporating facial recognition software known as Blue Wolf into its mass surveillance of Palestinians across the West Bank. What will this look like, and what will it mean for Palestinians?
The Washington Post report pointed to another type of surveillance that you've mentioned, Yara, where Israeli authorities are monitoring Palestinians by integrating facial recognition with a growing network of cameras and smartphones. As the report mentioned, over the past 2 years, when the world was struggling with the pandemic, the Israelis were developing a new surveillance initiative called the Blue Wolf that captures photos of Palestinians' faces and matches them to a database of images. Later on, the phone app flashes in different colors to alert soldiers if a person is to be detained, arrested, or left alone. The report also mentioned another smartphone application called the White Wolf that has been developed for use by the settlers in the West Bank, so they can use the White Wolf app to scan Palestinians' identification card before the person enters the settlement. The military in 2019 acknowledged the existence of the White Wolf in the right-wing Israeli publications. Adding to that, the report was also talking about surveillance cameras that the Israeli authorities are using in Hebron, as I mentioned from before, and as Hamle also report mentioned about Jerusalem. And all of these are systematic efforts to surveil Palestinians, to prevent them from living their normal life, let's say, and also from practicing their normal life, especially people who are working in human rights documentation. But to be honest with you, if you are a Palestinian, you could not only be surveilled just because you are working in a human rights sector. As we have seen over the past couple of weeks, we saw a systematic efforts to surveil Palestinians, the normal people, in the streets, with the cameras, with these mobile applications. If you are going to work in the settlements or if you are staying in the West Bank. Yesterday, we saw also another or a new report on the Middle East Eye, where they were telling us that the Israeli authorities or the Israeli regime is also monitoring all the phone calls in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And that disaster, because people even they can call their loved ones or to talk to their loved ones as they want. And as a human rights defender, but also as a normal person who's living in Palestine, I feel that this could restrict not only the freedom of expression and not violating my privacy, it's also affecting my behavior. It's also affecting how I communicate with my close family, with my first circle people. So that also could, on the long term, could change people's behavior, could also change people's mindset on how they use these technologies and on how they also perceiving this kind of surveillance and dealing with that in their daily life. And also, it could affect people's trust with each other and also with their societies. And that's disastrous.
Yeah, well, I think it's really important to highlight how the Israeli regime manages to infiltrate even the most intimate areas of life, even the communication with your closest family members and friends. If we go back for a moment to the notion that Palestine is this laboratory or testing ground for these kinds of surveillance technologies, what implications does this have for the rest of the world?
Let's have a starting point. Colonial and oppressive regimes usually agree on one point, which is the oppression of people. For this, the Israeli regime usually sells these technologies to other repressive regimes in general, and to the regimes in the global south in particular. And this has an impact on the safety of the people first. And contrary to the image that security companies and governments usually export, that these technologies are important to maintain safety of people, I see that the first place, it violates people's safety, people's privacy, and it works to normalize militarization and securitization in people's subconscious, thus violating their right to privacy. And because oppressive regimes and colonial regimes usually do not allow anyone to criticize them, so they use these techniques to prevent people from expressing their right to freedom of opinion and expression, and thus preventing them from their right to self-determination. So we feel with all oppressed people who usually suffer with their governments, with the regime, because of the use of surveillance technologies, especially those imported from the Israeli regime. If we have like a look back into other regimes' history, like the UAE regime, for example, we can see how they also use the same technology, which is NSO or Pegasus, against their political opponent. For example, there is a human rights defender who passed away like a couple of months ago called Alaa, and she was living in the United Kingdom because she can't go back to the UAE. And after her death, we remember that they discovered that there was an SO in her mobile phone. Also, Jamal Khashoggi was having such spyware in his mobile phone. And in Morocco, the government was using surveillance technologies, specifically the NSO, against their political opponents and against the human rights defenders and lawyers in the previous years. They have a long history how they are using that. And in a systematic matter, that these regimes are using these against journalists who could criticize them, against political opponents and activists and the human rights defenders. And it's clear that these colonial and oppressive regimes, they have like one mission, which is surveil people and prevent people from living in a safe world without having this kind of feeling of being surveilled and monitored all the time.
So Muna, with all of that in mind and considering everything we've discussed, how can Palestinians protect themselves from this kind of all-pervasive surveillance? And what about non-Palestinians? What can they do to disrupt Israeli surveillance in Palestine, but also Israeli surveillance exports?
So for Palestinians, I have this kind of fear that we can't trust like our devices. We can't trust the technology. The technology usually is being utilized by oppressive regimes and also by colonial regimes to suppress people. And that's unfortunate that it's being used against us, against Palestinians. And because of that, Palestinians should be aware that we can't trust technology and we can't trust anything that is being shared online. Communicating with our people is very important, and using technology, utilizing technology to spread our narrative to the world is also important. But we should keep in mind that someone is watching us all the time while we are chatting with our even closest family members or beloved ones. And because of that, people should be aware and should like educate themselves more and more about the digital safety and the digital security tactics where they can protect themselves and protect their family members and their colleagues and friends. So the first thing is raising awareness in the digital security practices that is really needed for the young people, for everyone in our society. And we should keep in mind that the Israelis, as the Guardian report mentioned, that they use specific information about people who they surveil, like with the LGBT community, with the females and so on, to intimidate them and to prevent them from practicing or living their normal life, and sometimes to get more information from them about their society. Being aware of what could happen is very important. Change your settings. Your mobile settings should be the safest. We know even if we change that, even if we like prevented the location and so on, some applications could access your location. But we should keep in mind, we should make our maximum effort to prevent any kind of surveillance. We should not like click on any suspicious link. And I'm afraid of mentioning that because now NSO is being developed to be zero-click malicious spyware. But for others, others can also do for Palestinians. They can support Palestinians and support themselves. They can escalate the pressure on their governments, on their MPs, on their Congress representatives to prevent buying these technologies from the Israeli regime and to have a better legislation that prevents their security forces, their governments of using such surveillance spywares, let's say, and surveillance technologies. They can also, through their government, through their representatives, escalate the pressure to prevent Israelis from using these technologies against Palestinians. Because we believe that the international pressure could do something for Palestinians. We've seen in May how, with the international pressure, how amplifying Palestinian voices, how the international pressure was really re-centralizing the Palestinian cause and putting that in the center. And by doing that, it was, let's say, it was fruitful to some extent. And because of that, we should escalate the pressure more and more and prevent their governments to buy such surveillance technologies.
Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you, Yara. Thanks for having me.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Since we've been talking about it for over a year, and you probably already know anyway, we've decided not to say it this time. So we're not going to tell you again that to protect yourself from COVID-19, you should wash your... And we certainly won't repeat once more that you should wear a... Or most importantly, that we must keep our... From others. Because you already know this is the best way to fight the virus. Even when you're vaccinated, let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The FM band is from 88 megahertz up to 108.
You've got this frequency. We're going to call you CKUT. You've got this frequency, 98.3. That frequency is what you're picking up when you tune that radio.
Very impressive.
You can sit on the moon and look like they pick up CKUT, clear as a bell.
Fascinating. Your analysis seems logical.
CKUT.